Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents High Treason by John Gilstrap, narrated by Basil Sands.
Chapter 1. In all his 17 years with the United States Secret Service, Special Agent Jason Knapp had never felt this out of place, this exposed. The January chill combined with his jumpy nerves to create a sense of dread that rendered every noise too loud, every odor too intense, rendered the night far too dark. With his Sig Sauer P-229 on his hip and an MP5 submachine gun slung under his arm, not to mention his 5 teammates on Cowgirl's protection detail, he couldn't imagine a scenario that might get away from them. But sometimes you get that niggling voice in the back of your head that tells you that things aren't right. Years of experience had taught Knapp to listen to that voice when it spoke. Oh, that Mrs. Darman would learn to listen to her protection detail. Oh, that she would listen to anyone. While he himself rarely visited the White House residence, stories abounded among his colleagues that Cowgirl and Champion fought like banshees once the doors were closed. She never seemed to get the fact that image mattered to presidents, and that first ladies had a responsibility to show a certain decorum. Clearly, she didn't care. These late-night party jaunts were becoming more and more routine, and Knapp was getting sick of them. He understood that she rejected the traditional role of first lady, and he got that, despite her renown, she wanted to have some semblance of a normal life. But the steadily increasing risks she took were flat-out irresponsible. Tonight was the worst of the lot. It was one thing to dash out to a bar on the spur of the moment with a reduced protection detail. First spouses and children had done that for decades. But to insist on a place like the Wild Times Bar in Southeast D.C. was a step too far. It was 5 steps too far. Great disguise notwithstanding, Cowgirl was a white lady in a very dark part of town, and it was nearly 1 in the morning. Throw in all those bodies floating in Lake Michigan from the as-yet-unresolved East-West Airlines explosion last week, and you had a recipe for disaster. Knapp stood outside the main entrance to the club, shifting from foot to ward away the cold. Charlie Robinson flanked the other side of the door, and together they looked like the plain-clothed version of the toy soldiers that welcomed children to the FAO Schwartz toy store in Manhattan. He felt at least that conspicuous. 20 feet away, Cowgirl's chariot, an armored Suburban, idled in the handicap space at the curb, its tailpipe adding a cloud of condensation to the night. Inside the chariot, Jean Tompkins sat behind the wheel, no doubt reveling in the warmth of the cab. Bill Lansing enjoyed similar bragging rights in the follow car that waited in the alley behind the bar. Typical of OTR movements, off the record, the detail had chosen silver Suburbans instead of the black ones that were so ubiquitous to official Washington, in hopes of drawing less attention to themselves. They'd driven here just like any other traffic, obeying stoplights and using turn signals the whole way. On paper, that meant you remained unnoticed. But a Suburban was a Suburban, and if you looked hard enough, you could see the emergency lights behind the windows and the grill. Throw in the well-dressed white guys standing like toy soldiers, and they might as well have been holding flashing signs. In these days of Twitter and Facebook, when rumors traveled at the speed of light, all it would take for this calm night to turn to shit would be for somebody to connect some very obvious dots. While the good citizens of the District of Columbia had more or less unanimously cast their votes to sweep Champion into office, they'd since turned against him. It didn't stretch Knapp's imagination even a little to envision a spontaneous protest. Then again, Cowgirl was such a media magnet that he could just as easily envision a spontaneous TMZ feeding frenzy. Neither option was more attractive than the other in this neighborhood. The Wild Times was doing a hell of a business. The main act on the stage was a rapper of considerable local fame. Or maybe he was a hip-hopper. How do you tell the difference? And he was drawing hundreds of 20-something kids. Within the last 20 minutes, the pace of arrivals had picked up, and almost nobody was leaving. From a tactical perspective, the 2 agents inside with Cowgirl Peter Campbell and Dusty Binks, the detail supervisor, must have been enduring the tortures of the damned. In an alternate world where the First Lady might have given a shit, no one would have been allowed to touch the protectee. But in a nightclub situation, where the headliner's fans paid good money to press closer to the stage, preventing personal contact became nearly impossible. For the most part, the arriving revelers projected a pretty benign aura. It was the nature of young men to swagger in the presence of their girlfriends. And with that came a certain tough guy gait. But over the years, Knapp had learned to trust his ability to read the real thing from the imitation. Over the course of the past hour, his warning bells hadn't rung even once, until right now. A clutch of four guys approached from the north, and everything about them screamed malevolence. It wasn't just the gangsta gait and the gangsta clothes. In the case of the leader in particular, it was the eyes. Knapp could see the glare from 20 feet away. This guy wanted people to be afraid of him. "You see this?" he asked Robinson without moving his eyes from the threat. Robinson took up a position on Knapp's right.
"Handle it carefully," he warned.
More than a few careers had been wrecked by YouTube videos of white cops challenging black citizens. As the kids closed to within a dozen feet, Knapp stepped forward.
"Good evening, gentlemen," he said. "You know, it's pretty crowded inside."
"The hell out of my way," the leader said.
He started to push past, but Knapp body-blocked him. No hands, no violence. He just physically blocked their path.
"Look at the vehicle,"
Knapp said, nodding to the Suburban. "Take a real close look." Their heads turned in unison, and they seemed to get it at the same instant. "If any of you are armed, this club is exactly the last place you want to be right now. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"What?" the leader said. "Is it like the president or something?"
Knapp ignored the question.
"Here are your choices, gentlemen. You can go someplace else, or you can submit to a search right here on the street. If I find a firearm on any of you, I'll arrest you all, and your mamas won't see their boys for about 15 years. Which way do you want to go?"
Simple, respectful, and face-saving.
"Come on, Antoine," one of them said. "This place sucks anyway."
Antoine held Knapp's gaze for just long enough to communicate his lack of fear. Then he walked away, taking his friends with him.
"Nicely done, Agent Knapp," Robinson said.
They returned to their posts.
"Every time we do one of these late-night OTRs, I'm amazed by the number of people who keep vampire hours. Don't these kids have jobs to wake up for?"
Robinson chuckled.
"I figure they all drive buses or hazmat trucks."
With the Antoine non-confrontation behind them, Knapp told himself to relax. But in the world of gangbangers, you always had to be on your toes for the retaliatory strike. He couldn't imagine that Antoine and his crew would be in the mood to take on federal agents, but you never knew. He just wanted to get the hell out of here.
"Look left,"
Robinson said. Half a block away, a scrawny, filthy little man was doing his best to navigate a shopping cart around the corner to join their little slice of the world. The cart overflowed with blankets and assorted stuff, the totality of his worldly possessions, Knapp imagined. Aged somewhere between 30 and 80, this guy had the look of a man who'd been homeless for decades. There's a hunched movement to the chronically homeless that spoke of a departure of all hope. It would be heartbreaking if they didn't smell so bad.
"If Cowgirl sees him, you know she'll offer him a ride," Robinson quipped.
Knapp laughed. "And Champion will give him a job. Couldn't do worse than some of his other appointments." Knapp didn't share the First Family's attraction to the downtrodden, but he admired it. It was the one passion of the president's that seemed to come from an honest place. Knapp didn't want to take action against this wretched guy, but if he got too close, he'd have to do something. Though heroic to socialists and poets, the preponderance of homeless folks were, in Knapp's experience, nut jobs, harmless at the surface, but inherently unstable. They posed a hazard that needed to be managed. He felt genuine relief when the guy parked himself on a sidewalk grate and started to set up camp. Knapp's earpiece popped as somebody broke squelch on the radio.
"Lansing, Binks, bring the follow car to the front. Cowgirl's moving in about 3.
Thank God, Knapp said aloud, but off the air. Finally. He and Robinson shifted from their positions flanking the doors of the Wild Times to new positions flanking the doors to Cowgirl's chariot. He double-checked to make sure that his coat was open and his weapon available. A scan of the sidewalk showed more of what they'd been seeing all night. When the follow car appeared from the end of the block and pulled in behind the chariot, Knapp brought his left hand to his mouth and pressed the button on his wrist mic. "Binks, Knapp," he said, "we're set outside. Cowgirl is moving now." This was it. The moment of greatest vulnerability. Ask Squeaky Fromm, Sarah Jane Moore, or John Hinckley. These few seconds when the protectee is exposed are the moments of opportunity for suicidal bad guys to take their best shot. Robinson pulled open the Suburban's door and cheated his body forward to scan for threats from that end of the street, and Knapp cheated to the rear to scan the direction of the homeless guy and the real estate beyond him. He noted with some unease that the guy was paying attention in a way that he hadn't before. His eyes seemed somehow sharper. Knapp's inner alarm clanged. Ahead and to his left, the double doors swung out, revealing a clearly unhappy cowgirl, who seemed to be resisting her departure. She wasn't quite yelling yet, but assuming that past was precedent, the yelling would come soon. Movement to his right brought Knapp's attention back around to the homeless man, who suddenly looked less homeless as he shot to his feet and hurled something at the chariot. Knapp fought the urge to intercept the throw and instead drew his sidearm as he shouted, "Grenade!" He'd just leveled his sights on the attacker when an explosion ripped the chariot apart from the inside, the pressure wave rattling his brain and shoving him face first onto the concrete. He didn't know if he'd fired a shot, but if he had, it missed because the homeless guy was still standing. He'd produced a submachine gun from somewhere. A P-90, Knapp thought, but he wasn't sure. And he was going to town, blasting the night on full auto. Behind him, he knew that Campbell and Binks would be shielding Cowgirl with their bodies as they hustled her toward the follow car. In his ear, he heard Lansing shouting, "Shots fired! Shots fired! Agents down!" Once Knapp found his balance, he rolled to a knee and fired three bullets at the attacker's center mass. The man remained unfazed and focused, shooting steadily at the First Lady. Body armor, Knapp thought. He took aim at the attacker's head and fired three more times. The attacker collapsed. But the shooting continued, seemingly from every compass point. Had passers-by joined the fight? What the hell? Binks and Campbell were still 10 feet from the follow car when headshots killed them both within a second of each other. They collapsed to the street, bringing Cowgirl with them. She curled into a fetal ball and started to scream. Past her and over her head, bullets raked the doors of the follow car. Going that way was no longer an option. Keeping low, Knapp let his SIG drop to the pavement as he reached for his slung MP5. This wasn't time for aimed shots. It was time for covering fire. At this moment, the First Lady of the United States was far more important than any other innocents in the crowd. He held the weapon as a pistol in his left hand as he raked the direction he thought the new shots were coming from. With his right hand, he grabbed Cowgirl by the neck of her coat and pulled. "Back into the club!" he commanded as he draped his body over hers. To others, it might have looked as though she was carrying him on her back as he hustled her toward the front doors of the club, past the burning chariot and around the body of Charlie Robinson, who'd been torn apart by the blast. Knapp was still 5 steps away when searing heat tore through his midsection, driving the breath from his lungs and making him stagger. He'd taken that bullet for Cowgirl. He'd done his job. Now he just had to finish it. He had to get her inside. The next 2 bullets took him in the hip and the elbow. He was done, and he knew it. "Inside!" he yelled, as he pushed the First Lady as hard as he could. He saw her step through the doors the instant before a bullet sheared his throat. Chapter 2 Jonathan Grave waited at the Learjet's door while the stairway deployed. When it was down and locked, he centered his rucksack between his shoulders with a shrug and hefted the 2 green duffels that contained rifles and electronic gear. He turned his head to the right, where he could see Boxers, his longtime friend and cohort, in the cockpit shutting things down.
"Hey, Box, your ruck and the other duffels are here on the floor."
"Got it,"
Boxers said without looking.
Be sure to leave the heaviest ones for me. I don't want you hurting your little self.
Jonathan grinned.
I always do.
And in fact, he always did. A couple of inches shy of 7 feet tall, with a girth that made linebackers look puny, Boxers was easily the strongest man Jonathan had ever known. Big Guy always did the heavy lifting. As Jonathan made his way down the narrow stairs onto the tarmac, it occurred to him that this would be the first time in a long while he wouldn't need to spend 12 hours after an O-300 mission cleaning weapons and replacing gun barrels and receivers. The mission had been a quick one, and surprisingly uncomplicated. They hadn't even fired a shot. As a rule, the covert side of Security Solutions didn't get involved with recovering errant young people from the clutches of cults. But this case had had the feel of a kidnapping. At least, that's what the family had thought, though the FBI disagreed. The kid's father, Daddy Lottabucks, contacted Jonathan through the usual combination of cutouts and fake email addresses and was anxious to pay the gate rate for Jonathan's services. In the end, when Jonathan and Boxers crashed the door to recover the PC, precious cargo, the cult leader just handed the kid over. That fact alone, the absence of shooting, helped explain Boxer's fouler-than-usual mood. For the Big Guy, self-actualization had a lot to do with wreaking havoc. It wasn't that he was homicidal, not really, but rather that he enjoyed the efficiency of solutions that created fire and noise. Jonathan waited at the base of the stairs for Boxers. He had to laugh when the Big Guy's massive frame filled the doorway. With his ruck in place and the two duffels in his hands, squeezing through the door took on the elements of a high school physics calculation.
"There's some butter in the galley if you need to slather up," Jonathan quipped.
"My mama's womb had a bigger opening than this,"
Boxers grumped. Jonathan let it go. No matter how close the friendship, jokes about men's mothers were eternally off-limits.
"I vote you tell Mannix we're done with his sardine can,"
the Big Guy said when he joined his boss on the tarmac.
Austin Mannix had thrown in 2 years' access to his private plane when Jonathan negotiated the fee for this latest job.
Given their line of work, it helped to have air service that was traceable to a third party. Commercial aviation options were out of the question. Between the two of them, they carried enough weapons, ammunition, and explosives to repel an invasion.
You never knew what might go wrong on even the simplest of ops. So it always paid to be prepared.
One man's preparation, though, was a TSA agent's heart attack. But man, this plane was tiny.
"We'll see," Jonathan said. "At least it's based in Fredericksburg."
Other airplanes they'd negotiated for had been hangared in Dulles and Leesburg, easily an hour farther away from Jonathan's home in Fisherman's Cove.
"You say that like it's a good thing. It's still a long friggin' drive."
Again, Jonathan let it go. Jonathan knew how much money the Big Guy made for his contributions to Security Solutions. And there wasn't a community from Miami to New York City where he couldn't afford to live comfortably. Very comfortably. The fact that he'd chosen the hustle of Georgetown over bucolic Fisherman's Cove was his own problem. Crossing in front of the Civil Aviation Terminal building, Jonathan plotted a straight-line walking course toward the Batmobile, Boxer's pet name for Jonathan's customized and armored black Hummer H2. While not especially fast, the truck held its own on the highway, but it truly earned its keep off-road, where, despite its weight, it could climb trees once you engaged the four-wheel drive. He hadn't paid attention to the nearby vehicles until the doors of a black sedan opened in unison and disgorged two men in suits and sunglasses.
"At last," Boxers grumbled. "The day gets interesting. You thinking good guys or bad guys?"
"Feds,"
Jonathan said, knowing full well that he hadn't answered the Big Guy's question.
"Just so we're clear," Boxers said. "If they draw, I draw."
He'd long been on the record that he would never tolerate any form of incarceration, whether at the hands of a foreigner or the local constabulary. Like anyone who had to deal with the meddling bullshit that doubled these days for due process, he had a particular hard-on for feds.
"Let's clear our hands, then," Jonathan said.
He dropped his two duffels to the concrete, reducing his weight by 100 pounds, and clearing the way for him to draw the Colt 1911-45 that always rode high on his right hip. Loaded with 8 rounds, one hot in the chamber,
That was 6 more bullets than he'd need if it came to a shootout. Boxers likewise dropped his duffels to clear access to his holstered 9mm Beretta. They kept their gait steady as they approached the two men who'd clearly meant to intimidate them more than they had. You might even say they looked a little frightened themselves. The guy on the driver's side lifted his hands to show that they were empty.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa, guys," he said. "We mean no harm."
Jonathan shifted his eyes to the other one.
"And you?"
He stopped striding when good guys and bad guys were separated only by 20 feet and a door panel. Mr. Passenger Side resisted joining the program. He took a hesitant step back, then stood his ground. His hands remained out of sight at his sides when he said, "We've done nothing to threaten you."
"It's more about you feeling threatened," Boxer said with a grin.
"Don't be an idiot, Kane," the driver said.
Closing in on 50, the driver had an easy 20 years on the younger man named Kane. One of the greatest gifts of maturity and experience was the ability to read the dynamics of a situation for what they were. They were definitely feds, Jonathan decided, and the different degrees of swagger defined in his mind the difference between old school and new school. Since 9/11, federal law enforcers had been bestowed with remarkable power that they seemed oddly incapable of not overflexing.
"Let me guess," Jonathan said. "FBI.
Actually, the matching high-and-tight hairstyles and attention to fashion spoke more of Secret Service, but he couldn't imagine how this could be their jurisdiction.
"Yes, sir," the driver said. "Special Agent Edward Schramm. This is Special Agent Carlton Kane. We both report out of headquarters in Washington. I'd be happy to show you my creds if you promise not to go Chuck Norris on me."
"Not necessary," Jonathan said. "I have every confidence that you have the skill to forge a set of creds if you are so inclined." He drilled Kane with his gaze.
"Son, if you don't show me an empty pair of hands right by God now, we're going to have an issue."
Somewhere north of 18 and south of 35, Kane had the look of a quarterback from a second-tier school. He had a lot of neck, but not much girth, and the kind of self-righteous smirk that Jonathan loved so dearly to wipe away.
"I'm a federal officer, Mr. Grave. I'd be careful." "Oh, for God's sake," Schramm said. "Give it a rest. Either show him your hands or draw down on him. Just stop dancing."
Jonathan liked Schramm. Grudgingly, Carlton Kane raised his palms so that Jonathan could see them.
"Thank you," Jonathan said. He felt tension drain from his shoulders. "So what's up, gentlemen?"
Schramm answered quickly, as if hurrying to get in before his younger partner could screw things up.
"I have orders from my boss's boss, Director Rivers. I believe you know her as Wolverine, to talk you into taking a ride in the car with us."
Boxers made a growling sound that perfectly reflected Jonathan's unease.
"Where would we be going, and why?"
"That's need to know, sir," Schramm said. "I can't answer that."
"You want us to go with you to a place where we have no need to know where we're going?"
Boxers asked with a derisive chuckle.
"What are you fibbies smoking these days?"
"We're the ones who don't have a need to know," Kane said. Jonathan cocked his head and smiled at the illogic.
"And how are you going to drive us to a place you're not authorized to know?"
"I'm betting they drive blindfolded,"
Boxers quipped. Schramm forced a smile that looked more like a wince.
"We know the where, Mr. Vandermeulenbrocky, although I suspect that it's only a first step. What we don't know is the why."
The fact that he knew Boxer's name was a card well played.
"Suppose we say no," Jonathan asked.
Schramm seemed ready for that one. "When I asked the director that very same question, she guaranteed me that you would say yes if I told you she said it was important. The choice to come along or stay is entirely yours." He paused and shrugged. "That's it. That was the speech I was told to make." Jonathan inhaled deeply through his nose and vigorously rubbed his chin. He'd known Irene Rivers for years, since long before she ran a field office, let alone been named director. He'd done the kind of work for her that the FBI officially never did, yet needed to do to protect the citizens of the United States. Her Wolverine codename had started as a joke nearly 2 decades ago, a quasi-insult that reflected her feisty personality. As so often happened in the unpredictable world of nicknames, it stuck as her handle within the tiny covert world of security solutions. The only way for these two Phibbies to know that the name even existed would be if Irene had shared it with them.
Does this have anything to do with the East-West Airlines attack?
Nearly a week ago, an as-yet unidentified bad guy had launched a Stinger anti-aircraft missile into a fully loaded 747 as it climbed out of its takeoff from O'Hare International Airport. The perfect shot had scattered burning aircraft in human parts over a mile-long swath of Lake Michigan. "We don't yet know that that was a terrorist attack," Kane said. That was the official line of the government to stave off panic, but insiders knew the reality. Whether Kane was too young to be among those insiders was a topic for the future.
"Okay," Jonathan announced. "We'll come with you."
Boxer's eyes popped.
"We will?"
Jonathan shrugged.
"If Director Rivers requests the pleasure of our company, it's only polite that we accept the invitation."
Boxer smiled and scowled, simultaneously. It was an odd combination of expressions that was unique to him. Jonathan read it as a kind of amused tolerance, and perhaps a touch of anticipation that he might get to shoot something after all. Before the smile could fully form on Schramm's face, Jonathan added,
"But you come with us, not the other way around, in our vehicle."
"Absolutely not," Kane said. Jonathan didn't drop a beat.
"Then this conversation is over," he said.
He turned on his heel and started walking back toward the bags they'd dropped. Boxers followed.
"Wait,"
Schramm said. Jonathan stopped, turned.
"What are you doing?"
Kane asked aghast. His ears turned red when he was upset. Jonathan found that amusing, cute even, like he needed a hug and a teddy bear.
"We'll do it your way,"
Schramm conceded. Kane's jaw dropped.
"We will?"
Jonathan winked at the big guy.
"Deja vu,"
he mouthed. Schramm said to his protege,
"I have orders from as high up as I can imagine. If you were Mr. Grave, would you climb into a car with us?"
"I would do what a federal agent told me to do," Kane said. "Way to defend your position to the very end."
"Then you're an idiot," Schramm said.
Jonathan laughed. So did Boxers, and he was a much tougher audience. When Kane turned purple, it was as good as it got.
"Follow me,"
Jonathan said. He turned again, walked to the dropped duffels, and picked them up, Boxers with him every step. He led the four-man parade to the Batmobile and waited while Boxers thumbed the remote to unlock the doors. He called over his shoulder,
"Don't get in until I tell you."
He didn't look back to confirm compliance, because that would have telegraphed weakness. From this point on, the Phibbies needed to do exactly what he instructed them to do. With the cargo bay doors open, Jonathan and Boxers heaved the heavy duffels onto the floor.
"Do I even want to know what's inside those bags?" Kane asked.
"I'm sure you do," Boxers said, "which is sort of a shame."
When purple transitioned to grape, Jonathan actually started feeling sorry for the guy.
"Here's the deal," Jonathan said. "My friend will drive. Agent Schramm, you and Agent Kane will ride in the middle row of seats, and I will sit behind you."
Kane opened his mouth to say something, but Schramm put a hand on his arm. They all ended up in their assigned seats. Jonathan boarded last, taking the spot behind everyone. He didn't really expect the agents to try to hijack the ride, but if they did, he'd nail them both. One could never be too careful.
"So,"
Boxer said, once the doors were all closed,
"where are we going?"
David Kirk never picked up his phone on the first ring, or the third ring for that matter. He was a fifth ring guy. He figured that if someone really wanted to speak to him, they'd wait at least that long. On the sixth ring, the call would have gone to his voicemail.
"Washington Inquirer," he said as he snatched up the receiver. "This is David."
"Yo," a familiar voice said. "This is Deshaun. Have you got a few minutes?"
David rolled his eyes. Deshaun Lincoln was one of David's bar buddies. He was also a disgruntled rookie in the Metropolitan Police Department, which made him a reliable source for the kind of salacious news that city editors publicly decried yet secretly loved because it sold a hell of a lot of newspapers.
"Hi, Deshi," David replied. "What's up, man? I've always got a few minutes for you."
The usual smile was missing from Deshaun's voice.
"What's up is my boss's heads, completely up their own asses."
David's spidey sense tingled. Are you calling because...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?